Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. Hi, Mike. Thank you very much for joining us today. We know you're really busy, so we appreciate the time you're giving us to kind of go over this verifiable claims task force thing. We are, you know, when we run these calls, we minute them because we're gonna be reporting to the Web Payments Interest Group and the Verifiable Claims Task Force and a bunch of W3C membership folks. So we minute the calls and we do audio recording. If you do not want this call to be recorded, just let us know and we can shut it off. So that's just a heads up. Let us know if you're not okay with either one of those things.
No, that's fine.
Okay. And then to kind of start off, it would be good if you could just give us a quick introduction of yourself so that the rest of the folks in W3C kind of know who you are and what you do and that kind of stuff. And then after we do that, we can go through this agenda that we have that we just posted in IRC. You know, we're going to go over kind of the problem statement that the Verifiable Claims Task Force is looking at, looking on some definitions, user-centric design versus service-centric, and discussing differences between that, stakeholders and benefits. And really, you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get your thoughts on this. It's not, you know, while this is like the proposed agenda, we'd like the call to be driven by you. So wherever you think we should kind of deviate or focus, we'd love to hear that, and you know, feel free to just, you know, talk about anything that you feel is interesting that's related to this area.
I see.
Sound good?
Sure. Well, I could start with an intro. I'm Mike Schwartz. I'm the founder and CEO of Glue, GLUU.org. We are an open source software developer, and we are produce an identity provider product called the Glue Server, which is used to authenticate individuals centrally. And the Glue Server integrates a number of open source components, including the Shibboleth SAML identity provider. We have our own project that we call Ox, O-X, and we have a number of components in there, including Ox Auth, which is an OpenID Connect provider. And we also have a SAML proxy and an LDAP server. So the Glue server is really like a distribution of free open source components that an organization can use to centrally authenticate people and to offer APIs to applications to enable them to leverage that. And so I guess over the years, I've been active in implementing open standards like SAML and OpenID Connect and also the UMA profile, OAuth2, which is for authorization. And I'm currently also co-chair of a Kantara group, working group called OTTO, the Open Trust Taxonomy for OAuth2. And this is a working group that's trying to define a new way for a central authority to vet organizations and the Federation identity services that they provide to drive down the cost and the technical and legal barriers to collaboration, especially inter-domain collaboration. So that's sort of a quick overview. Over the last, before starting Glue, I was an identity management consultant for more than a decade, and also have been active in a lot of efforts around enhancing users' privacy and giving users more control of their information. And so I guess over the years, I've seen a lot of efforts in this area, and I have some thoughts. I don't know if they'll be helpful thoughts, but I'm happy to share them.
No, I'm positive they're going to be very helpful thoughts, especially given the amount of experience that you have in this area. So, in looking into this work, you know, SAML, OpenID Connect, Shibboleth, LDAP, all of those have come up. So it's really useful to have somebody that has direct experience with all those initiatives. So yeah, we're really looking forward to the conversation and learning a lot from you. So thank you again for being here. We'd like to kind of start with the problem statement to set the stage of, in general, what we're trying to work on, and get your thoughts on the problem statement. So the reason that these series of interviews are happening is because we need to make sure that we are not trying to solve a problem that's already solved, or solve a problem that is so sticky that we're going to potentially fail, right? We're trying to avoid pitfalls. We're trying to narrowly scope the problem. So that is why we've come up with this problem statement. We're talking with folks like Christopher Allen, who was the co-editor of the SSL and TLS specifications. We're talking with Dick Hart, who has done a lot in the identity 2.0 space. We're talking with Brad Hill from Facebook, who also chairs the web application security space. So we're trying to get all these people's input as to whether or not we've got the problem statement defined correctly, and then we want to hear about whether or not you think SAML or LDAP or any of the other initiatives you're involved in could solve these problems, right? So let's go ahead and kind of dive into the problem statement, and let me get a link for you, problem statement. Problem. There we go. So here's a link to the problem statement there in IRC. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out a way to differentiate this work from, for example, the SAML and OpenID work that has happened before. So the problem that we're trying to solve is something that we're asserting that OpenID and SAML don't necessarily solve, or in architectures built in that mechanism don't solve this particular problem. So we start out by saying that there's currently no widely used user-centric standard for expressing and transacting verifiable claims, also known as credentials and attestations, via the web, right? And when we say user-centric, we're being pretty kind of specific. It's kind of a charged word, but Christopher Allen calls it self-sovereign, where people are in charge of or are in control of when their credentials are used and who can use them and who can access them. It's a very privacy enhanced way of sharing these credentials. So the idea is that an organization such as the DMV or the U.S. Passport Office issues a credential. They're given to a credential holder, which is a person that stores their credential in a location of their choosing, and then they go to somewhere else on the web, and that other place on the web says, "Hey, show me your digital driver's license, or show me your digital passport, or proof of age," and then they provide that data, that credential, to the requesting site. So that's kind of
right.
The ecosystem.
Yeah, maybe we should break there and unpack just that first part a little bit before we go any further.
Sure.
There's a guy who, if you're going to keep doing interviews, there's another guy you might want to talk to. His name's Scott David, and he's a law professor at the University of Washington. And he gave me a very useful sort of like framework for understanding this area. And he breaks privacy into a triangle. And at one, each of the sort of points of the three points of the triangle are level of assurance, level of protection, and level of control. And all three of these, when you read various regulations about privacy, you can go through and sort of tag them. Are they addressing assurance, protection, or control? So, and all three of these are essential, but sometimes they get mixed together, and that creates difficulties in discussing privacy and user control. So level of assurance is used by the website, and it needs assurance that the person on the other, you know, at the end of that stream of electrons really is the person it thinks it is. So you hear level of assurance talked about the most because the government, NIST, has defined four levels of assurance, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and these are overused in the industry. And the reason why this is the most important one is that the government really wants to know it's you when they're transacting business.
Right.
So that one I think a lot of people understand. It's level of protection and level of control that are less well understood. Level of protection is the responsibility of the website to protect the data. So when the government receives their data, how does it store that data? How does it protect it? We've seen that the government, particularly the IRS, the Department of, which was the Department of, it's the one that had all the human resources data. Anyway, they didn't do a good job protecting the data,
right,
and it was stolen. I think it was the Department of Personnel Management, something like that. Anyway, they did a bad job protecting the data. So they were very, very interested in telling and making sure it was you, but then they fell down in the protection area. They were less interested in defining the rules about how they were going to protect it. So that's the second part of the triangle. And so those are the two parts we have the most legislation about. So we also have quite a bit of LOP legislation. For example, in HIPAA, you'll see that the healthcare providers have to store the data encrypted in GOP. So you'll see that there is some level LOP legislation like kind of sprinkled out, but it's in a lot of different places. And then the last piece of the triangle that is generally forgotten is level of control. And that is the right of the individual to control the data. So do I have the right to delete my data? Do I have the right to correct my data? Do I have the right of controlling who can share my data with who?
Right.
And so in this area, the level of control area, we have very poor legislation and very poor protections. And maybe we have better protections we're starting to get some better protections in certain states and in certain countries. But in general, it was sort of the last one that was thought about because there was more business interest in defining and protecting assurance and protection than in control.
Right.
So now, before you get any further, I think that a really important question you have to consider in this area is personal data property, something that you can own, or is it something else? These are questions that I highly recommend you raise with Scott David. They're really fundamental questions that can change your perspective on the whole problem. For example, let's just take a hospital use case. So hospitals are required to keep records for like 7 years, or doctors for that matter. So do you as a patient have the right to go to the doctor and say, delete my data? No, you don't actually. They have to have that data. So it becomes very sticky, and I think that if you look at data as a property right, you run into trouble.
Right, and so let me clarify that really quickly. We're not looking at the data in that way. I think it's important to raise those questions and that kind of stuff. But the core of the problem statement is around being able to store certain types of data. So we're not talking about all data here. So we're not talking about personal clouds or, just raw data. We're talking specifically about verifiable claims, like, you know, a driver's license, U.S. passport, things of that nature. And these claims are things that other organizations give you to hold on to. So we're not making any kind of assertion on whether that's your data or the other organization's data. We're saying there are some organizations that want to issue a credential to you and have you hold on to that credential and give them somewhere else. It's much closer to, for example, like a wallet, right? So you stick your driver's license and maybe your social security card and your loyalty card in your wallet and you carry it around with you. We're trying to bring that to the web, to the digital world.
Let me just go on. So it's when I see user-centric, though, what I hear is that you want to define an architecture which facilitates user control of the data. Right. Does that sound right?
Not control. Well, let's break down the word control. Actually, you know what? Let's compare and contrast. So systems exist today, like Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus, and you use those systems to make assertions on your behalf. So this is kind of like OpenID Connect. You've got an IDP and a relying party, and we're calling those systems service-centric, which is your identity is pretty tightly coupled to the identity provider, and the identity provider is kind of in the middle, right? They're the ones that have to exist in order to assert certain attributes about you to the relying parties. So we're calling that service-centric, and we're saying that there exists this other model. The other model is that there is no tight coupling between the issuer of the credentials and the identity provider. In fact, we split them into two parties, and it's really the credential holder that decides where to store that stuff.
Okay.
And we're calling that user-centric.
I was going to get there, but first of all, I think you probably know this, but maybe I'll just make the distinction just to be clear. So a credential is something that enables you to prove that it's you. So like a password or something you know, a private key that maybe you have on a token. Those are credentials. But attributes would be pieces of information about you or user claims in OAuth jargon.
Right, and we're talking about the latter. So I think there's the terminology mismatch. When we say credential, we mean in the dictionary definition of credential, which is a set of attributes about a particular entity, right?
I think that's going to be trouble, though, because credential is going to be you're thinking of credential like maybe I show you my driver's license and that has attributes on it.
Right.
It's going to be really confusing for identity people to hear you talk about user claims and attributes and call them credentials.
Okay. So let's do the mapping on the call. So whenever we say credential, what we actually mean is, you know, user attributes and you know, verifiable claims and things of that nature.
It's a useful distinction, actually, because where your credentials are and where your credentials, let's just say that you don't need your credentials in nearly as many places as your user claims are stored. Let's just take my university. My university might be authoritative for the fact of what degree I obtained and what my GPA was. But my university doesn't need to store my password or my private key. So the trend has really been to minimize the amount of places that you store your credentials. But your user claims are by definition distributed, sort of because there are different authorities that are able to assert different claims about you. Also, I really have an issue with your definition of, let's say, OpenID Connect as service provider related. I understand technically you're saying that the website might get the information by querying the service provider, not the person, but that's a technicality. It doesn't matter who provides those attributes. Identity always exists in the context of a domain. If I tell you self-asserted information is not useful. It might be useful for pseudonymous or anonymous transactions, but self-asserted information is really not useful for transacting business for the most part. We always want to know the identity attributes in the context of a level of assurance, which can only be provided by a domain, and whether that domain provides it directly by calling like the user info endpoint in OpenID Connect, or whether they sign something and put it on a smart card for you to deliver in person without an intermediary is really irrelevant. What's important is that this domain has basically signed or somehow verified that this attribute is in fact associated with you. And that's the real problem I have with your I like the idea of user-centric if it means user control. But if user-centric means that we're talking about information outside of the context of the domain, I just don't think that's very useful for
anything. Yeah, we're not. So we're talking about the first one. When we say user-centric, we mean, you know, the user is in control of, you know, where those verifiable attributes are stored and where they're sent. And as for whether or not you can trust those attributes, clearly they have to come from a domain where there's a shared trust, right? So whoever you're giving those claims to, they're going to check the domain that made the assertion on those attributes, and if they trust the domain, then they trust that the attributes are probably correct, right? So does that help clarify a bit?
Yeah, because I think that the identity information always is in the context of a domain. So then, if
right.
the question is just technically, what would be the best transport and storage mechanism for the attributes? Is there an opportunity to create a new type of storage scheme for identity information?
Mm-hmm.
I think the answer is probably yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, OpenID Connect and SAML are very specific identity solutions,
mm-hmm.
And they are not supposed to be a panacea for identity in general. The basic problem that they're solving is we need single sign-on across a number of websites, and that means that we want to rely on one central identity provider. So I don't know. I don't know that they what they're doing is fine, and also they're heavily reliant on web technology and redirecting the user. And so it is what it is. I don't think anybody has any illusions about it being sort of the last identity solution that we're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of the best thing maybe that we have right now for web single sign-on, but
right.
there's a lot of, you know, gaps and there's a lot of new technology and innovation happening, so I don't think anybody sees this as the end technology for identity.
Okay.
If you look at some of the drivers for what came about it, I mean, I think that when you look at the trust model behind OpenID Connect and SAML, you start to find it to see more interesting opportunities for trust, because trust is really what has been difficult to achieve. The internet is the most decentralized, least trusted network out there, but, you know, possible. I don't trust any domain. And so what the challenge has been is how do we establish trust with a certain domain? And so OpenID Connect offers a trust model where basically it's very decentralized. I'm going to connect via TLS to an identity provider. I'm going to obtain its keys. But it's a very much a one-to-one relationship. I trust IDP1, I trust IDP2, I trust IDP3, There's no way to find out which IDPs do you trust. It's managed. The trust management is just not there yet. So this is the really hard question. In SAML, they have these things called multi-party federations, where you might have in common in the education industry. If you look on, I think it's incommon.org/participants, that's a good example of a central trust model where the in common organization, which is a nonprofit, vets the IDPs and the SPs or websites in this federation and publishes their keys and metadata in one place. And this is maybe a slightly more efficient trust model because I can see that, okay, you know, here are the 549 colleges that I trust, here are the 244 websites that I trust. But at the same time, this trust model has had scale problems. What if there's 10 million, you know, IDPs that I trust? How would that work? It wouldn't really scale. So, and the trust model maybe that you're defining, where there's some type of way to have a more distributed storage of user information that could be verified. I mean, I think there is an opportunity for that, yeah, it's new area. I don't know. You have to. I think it would take some work in looking at some of the barriers to some of these other technologies, especially the crypto barriers. Like, if you look at why was OAuth 1 not successful, and OAuth 2 ended up being successful. And one of the problems was defining in the protocol was a barrier to adoption. And so if the distributed solution that you're suggesting is based on signing, will it scale? It would be one of my questions. And are we just building a big PKI,
right,
which is something that I don't think we want to do.
Right.
So...
Right.
So yeah, the problem is a lot of history, and none of the solutions seem ideal.
Let me try and boil down the trust architecture that we're looking at, and see if you've got any high level thoughts on it. So the idea here is we're looking at islands of trust on the web and the internet, right? So the assertion is that we believe we can hit scale, like web type scale. With the trust model that's being worked on in the credentials community group. And to be clear, that is not a part of the work that we're discussing right now. It's just an experiment that we're running. But the idea here is that there are going to be consumers of credentials, consumers of verifiable attributes, right? So let's say let's take a simple example. An online wine store wants to be able to sell wine and beer and liquor and stuff like that to people that are coming online, but they have to make sure that they're above a certain age in order to do the sale. And they want to depend on some, you know, verifiable attribute where it's not the person self-asserting, it's, for example, the state government via driver's license or claim that you're over the age of 21. So the idea here is that that consumer of the credential is going to say, we accept credentials from these 50 plus providers, and they're just all the states, right? And so when the query goes through, when you go to your storage to get a credential, it'll know whether or not you can meet that claim or not. And so the idea here is not that the relationship isn't between the online wine store to a bunch of IDPs. It's the trust relationship is online wine store to all 50 states, just to looking at the U.S. And the European Union would probably solve this, you know, problem in a different way, and you know, the problem for healthcare would probably be solved in a different way than for, you know, wine stores.
Or let's just say the state, not all 50 states. I think I can maybe understand the state. Because
Okay.
the state is authoritative. Let's say you have a driver's license today. What
Right.
if you had a digital driver's license?
Yep.
To be honest, we're working on this exact problem with one of our customers right now in the state
Okay.
government area. And you're right. So you don't want to tell the liquor store your name and address. You just want to tell them I'm over 21.
Right.
So there's a two paths there. One, you could present some type of identifier to the wine store or to the liquor store, and they could make a connection to the state, the IDP. This is your Open ID Connect model. And then say, I have a user here. He's authorized the release of his age. Can you tell me his age?
Right.
And there, the trust model TLS, because the claims might be signed or might not be signed, but even if they're not signed, I know I have a secure connection to the state, and therefore I can trust the claims that are coming back.
Right. As
Your
long as
other
you have
examples.
a relationship with that IDP, and you'd have to have relationships with, potentially 10,000 different IDPs for that to work out,
Through
right?
dynamic registration, I don't have to have a pre-existing relationship with that IDP. I just have to be able to identify that IDP.
Right.
But through dynamic client enrollment, I can ask for a client ID in secret, and the user can authorize the release of the attribute. So that can all happen automatically today. That's not a problem. I don't have to get a client ID and get data release. But that Open ID Connect does that. But of course, there's a requirement for a connection. If my internet access goes down at the liquor store, or for some reason the IDP goes down, then I can't sign out of business. So the other mechanism is kind of like smart card technology, where the smart card contains the digitally signed attributes, and by having the root certificate, I can decrypt the attributes on the card or on the phone, and say, okay, I see. And then the application could be smart enough to release only the relevant information over 21. So those are the two. I mean, those are the two solutions I think we have today as possible. The Open ID Connect solution. So the idea that we'd have a big PKI. It's really like fraught with problems. You have to deal with revocation. There's other things. Like if I issue you a smart card, what if actually we discover that the smart card was issued fraudulently? But so if you really want to make it work, you need some type of revocation. So PKI sounds great, but then as you jump into the details, there are problems. And actually, maybe the barriers to making an SSL connection is less than the barriers of dealing with replication and other PKI issues. So, I don't know, do you see your solution potentially diverging from one of those two patterns, though?
Yeah, I think so. So the solution that we're looking at, and I don't want to go too deeply into this because we want to kind of look at what we're trying to do is we're not trying to talk about solutions yet, but we certainly have a number of experimental solutions, and they definitely deviate from the two options you mentioned right there, meaning that it's smart card like. But it exists purely, in the browser, and you don't need to have a connection between the identity provider and the relying party. The connection, including, with the revocation problem you outlined, that connection is between the issuer of the credential and effectively the relying party. But we have some, decentralized ledger mechanisms that allow you to protect privacy and check to see for revocation and ensure that your credential curator or your IDP doesn't have to be up at all times. So, anyway, there's a lot of technology there. I don't know. We don't have time to get into it today, but we'd be happy to have that discussion with you later on. So let me kind of go back to the problem statement. I think you have outlined, you're concerned about the user-centric terminology because it's a bit vague. So we had to clarify that. Our use of the word credential, you feel, is going to be confusing to people that deal with identity. And we definitely, that we have seen that happen before, and this has only helped underscore that. You did say during the discussion, as far as user-centric mechanism for expressing, attributes and claims, and making sure that the user's in control of that, and it's privacy protecting, the IDP doesn't know where you're using these assertions and things like that. Do you feel that SAML or OpenID or LDAP are equipped to solve that problem today? So that's the first question. Thoughts on that?
Well, OpenID Connect, the OP knows the clients that it released the attributes to. Mm-hmm. So the equivalent of the IDP in both SAML and OpenID Connect knows everywhere that you went. So you don't have privacy there. You do have non-correlation between the website. So the IDP can give out a different subject identifier to each website or set of related websites to enable or to make it harder for these websites to correlate a user. For example, if you give your Gmail address to every website, if those websites are working together, they'll be able to create a profile of you, of your usage across those websites. But if each one of them has a different address or a different identifier, they won't be able to do that correlation. So OpenID Connect supports that, and SAML implementation generally support that too, or some are able to. Shibboleth has this thing called persistent non-correlatable identifiers.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the IDP definitely knows everywhere you went and can do that correlation. In fact, probably stored those persistent identifiers so it can provide audit and security. But in terms, in that way, maybe the smart card solution is more privacy protecting because the issuer of the card has no idea where you use that card.
Right.
And I think that there is a lot of work. It's really hard to transact privately on the internet right now. It's not impossible. So I don't know. I'm sort of skeptical about that your ability to do that because of the network fingerprint that you end up leaving when you traverse the internet. So I have to admit, it hasn't been my biggest concern either.
Mm-hmm.
My main concern is that the universities that we serve are very concerned mm-hmm. about the use case that the users who are viewing content can do so anonymously, but at the same time still be identified with the institution. So, for example, mm-hmm. your college maybe has a license to a certain library service. So you need to tell this library service, I'm a student at this university, I should be able to access the content, but you don't want to tell them who you are. So that's the privacy use case that we've been concerned about.
Okay.
But I think there's a lot of opportunity there for, you see what's happening. So we couldn't be transacting less privately, it seems, on the internet. And private browsing doesn't help you very much.
Right. So the problem statement is kind of architected to figure out whether or not there is work here for us to do, right? So the Verifiable Claims Task Force is trying to figure out do we have consensus around particular work items that if we were to successfully complete that stuff, we would end up with a more privacy protecting, user centric way of expressing and transacting verifiable claims. Can you think
of... I'll tell you what the big gap is, actually. Most of the architectures assume that one IDP is authoritative for all your claims. And in a lot of cases, it turns out to be incorrect. that actually different organizations have different pieces of information about you. And the protocols that we have today were specifically not designed to solve that problem. How do you gather claims? So let's say the university example I gave is a good one, because only my university knows what my GPA was.
Right.
And in fact, my employer might need to verify that. You know, did I really get a degree? What was my GPA?
Right.
One thing if I say I had a 4.0, it's another thing if they say it. You know, one of the ideas I had recently was to propose a different type of OAuth2-based identity solution other than OpenID Connect. Because I'll put the link in the chat of this one.
Okay.
Because I felt like in OpenID Connect, the access token gives you access to the user info endpoint for that domain. So when OpenID, so when Google issues you an access token for OpenID Connect, you can find out what's this user's Gmail address, and that's it. You can't use that access token at any other domain. Even within Google, that access token doesn't do anything to you, except it's only good for that one endpoint.
Right.
So I had this idea of maybe using a different type of OAuth2 access token that you could maybe use at different OpenID Connect providers. So instead of using an OpenID Connect access token, if we used an UMA RPC token, maybe I could present this RPC token at different providers that had my claims. And let's say this RPC token was issued by a federation, let's say InCommon. So instead of getting the token from Washington University in St. Louis, I get the token from InCommon. And then I present this token for authorization or to allow access to different colleges. Let's say I went to undergrad in Wash U, maybe I got my master's degree at Yale and did postgrad at Harvard, graduate degree at Harvard. So by getting one token at a central authority like InCommon, maybe I could provide authorization for you to get attributes at those three institutions. And so you'd be able to take that token and find out what my GPA was and what degree I earned at those different universities. So I think that so OpenID Connect was really, and SAML was, the IDP is really authoritative just for one domain. And I think that there really is a big gap out there right now in how do we create a trusted profile of the user across many domains. So there's really a lot of gaps, actually, in the identity ecosystem. The main problem is it's hard to get adoption. It's hard to change user behavior. It's hard to get developers to network economies of scale, basically. So there's lots of barriers to getting identity infrastructure to work.
Okay, interesting. Do you feel that that gap is aligned at all with the problem statement, or do you think that the problem statement that we have in the Verifiable Claims Task Force is just misaligned with what you just said?
No, I think that there is a lot of room there. So if your basic idea is we want to create a way for that the user would have good control of her data, and be able to use that to transact business, I think that is a good idea. It's complicated, but it is a good idea. And I would also say that it should work within, it should leverage the existing infrastructures that are in place. Like OpenID Connect might give you a piece of the puzzle. OAuth2 software statements might give you a piece of the puzzle. So I think maybe to achieve what you're trying to achieve, You can leverage some of the existing infrastructure that's in place, but I do think it's pretty much unsolved. Actually, if you can solve this problem, I just posted today, they're in the healthcare industry, you know, they'll give you $1 million. I'll put in this link. It's not like people aren't trying to solve it. You know, let me post this link in to the chat. Figure out how to post stuff in. Can I just type something?
Yeah, you can. Or you should be able to Control-C, Control-V, copy-paste into the bottom. There's a little bar at the bottom. I don't know if you see that down there. So you have to kind of
type in. I think
it's
my browser's having a problem. Not working for me, but okay. So anyway, there's a Google article, not a Google article. It's called Chime, and I just tweeted this today. There's an article: Chime launches $1 million challenge to solve patient ID problem. Chime is the College of Healthcare Information Management Executives. And so a lot of the problems that you're talking about correspond pretty directly with efforts in the healthcare industry to enable patients to control, to have better control of their data. So
Got it.
It's a pretty hard problem. If you have an elegant solution that you believe you could get developers to adopt, and that has good usability, because that's really been the biggest problem with most of the solutions that get developed is that they don't factor in developer usability. So I don't know, if you have something that you think could solve this, the problem is definitely out there.
Okay, great. And I mean, you know, what we're trying to do is get consensus around the problem so that we can, you know, motivate the 400 plus W3C members to, you know, all charge in one direction instead of, you know, scrambling around like cats. So, and that's really the reason we're having this discussion with you, is to see if, you know, you think that there is a gap here that needs to be addressed, exactly what that gap is, and then whether or not you think that gap is something that is addressable. Like, is it such a hard problem that you're just saying, I have no idea how you'd go about it? It seems like what you're saying is, you know, they look like there are pieces out there that you could reuse for the problem, and then there's some gaps where you might need to invent some new technology, but it seems like a problem that is worth solving, and you can kind of see a path to that solution. Is that an accurate statement?
It's accurate except the last sentence. I don't see a path to the solution.
okay.
We're incrementally building on the infrastructure that we have and the experiences that we've had. Over the last, you know, 10 years or so, there have been some major changes, like some changes that you would consider are really silly, like moving from SOAP to RESTful services, web services,
right,
and moving from XML to JSON. The life cycle of identity standards definition has been like 5 years. And so changes like that have really like set back the time frame for, it's been really, really difficult. And then that getting adoption is really, really difficult. And the community is very jaded about, well, why should I implement now? There'll be something better next year. And even OpenID Connect, which had the backing of Google and Microsoft, which sort of gave them network economies of scale, like just right off the bat, because Google had so many users who wanted to use Google, you know, connect, you know, authenticate against Google. It gave them a huge, like, head start in pushing an identity standard. OpenID Connect has taken much longer, I think, than we anticipated, and in some ways is still behind SAML. For example, very few SaaS providers accept inbound OpenID Connect today. maybe one or two. I think Salesforce, not even Microsoft or Google is accepting inbound OpenID Connect. So I think that I see a sort of evolution of this identity technology over time, where we are adding pieces and gaining experience, and at the same time adapting to this incredibly changing set of requirements and technologies. And I'm very skeptical about any type of quick solution to this problem.
Right.
I think I would be happy to be wrong about that, but it seems very, very challenging problem.
So as far as, you know, where, you know, we're trying to also figure out where this work should happen. Like, you know, we've identified that there are a couple of gaps, that it's a really hard problem, that, you know, it might be best to iterate at it. But where should this work happen? So, for example, you know, we're operating out of the World Wide Web Consortium that also has a number of liaison between the ITF and OASIS. Is there any particular standardization body that you think has a set of members or people that would be best equipped to try and address some of these gaps you've identified?
I think that I'm not an expert on standards organizations. I don't know the W3C that well. It would be nice to maybe have a fresh look at the problem from a new space. The IETF, the participants in the OAuth2 group in particular, have been at it for a long time. They have long history and have certain, you know, prejudices towards the problem. So having a fresh look at the problem we've all been wrong for the last decade, and it might be, maybe you'll come up with something. So, but other than that, I think all of the organizations you mentioned seem like a perfectly, could be workable forums. I'm a big fan of OASIS. I love the governance of OASIS. It's a very well-run organization. IETF seems a little more chaotic to me. The way it's run by individuals participating and how standards, you could sit in a room and somewhere and write a draft and no one could participate, you know, contribute to it, and that could still be, you know. So I don't know. So the IETF
right.
has its pluses and minuses for a lot of people, but it has good format and gets lots of stuff. I don't know. I think that I would definitely engage with the identity experts at IETF, especially guys like John Bradley from Ping Identity. He's one of the gurus. Leif Johansson from Sweden, and George Fletcher from AOL. I can give you a couple of lists, but
yeah, that would be great if you could. And we're hoping to speak with John Bradley later next week. So, well, we've got him, but the other two you mentioned, we don't. So if you could do a quick intro with us and them, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. But I think the question is which problem space could you define well enough and address? I mean, I don't quite see where you're going with this. The other thing that I think maybe you're underestimating is the difficulty in identifying the person.
Right.
And people just sort of take this for granted, but how do you know that how do you actually identify the person who's providing you these claims? Is it biometric? Is it proof of possession? Is it multi-factor? This is so, I think that before you can even start sharing claims with a service provider, so think about it from the level of assurance, from the website's perspective. You're thinking about it very much from the level of control perspective. So when you think about it from the level of assurance perspective, how well was the person identified is really key to the integrity. And so you need to consider it from all three angles. And how to make the bridge, or how to bridge this gap between the digital world and the analog world, it's not as easy as you might think. And so I would say, figure out where that's going to fit into your solution. So from that bridge, you're sharing attributes, and how is that going to work, and how is it going to be better than what we have? But I do think there's room. I would say just don't scope it too big, and bite off a small piece of it, and then I think there's definitely a lot of room for contribution in this area.
Okay, great, great. So we're coming up at the at the hour mark, and I think you've said a number of things during the discussion today that have been really fantastic. So it's new data that we have, and we'll take it back to the group and share it in the final report. Before we end the call, are there any other concerns that you have with us starting work in this area, other than what you've pointed out? Any other big pitfalls or concerns that you have with what we're kind of proposing that we're going to try and address in the problem statement?
I don't think so. I think that, I wish you guys good luck. We talked about user-centric being very ambiguous, and I think that it will bias people against the effort in a way if you're not really specific about what that means. I think this area. One other thing I'll mention is that when people talk about level of assurance, the usual context for that is level of assurance of the identity. How sure am I it's the person?
Right.
But going beyond that, you would like relying party, the website, would actually also like a level of assurance with each claim. So I am this sure it's because this is the guy's name. I'm this sure it's his GPA. So these are the sorts of tangles you get into. Distributed, many IDPs, let's say, being authoritative for claims, having different levels of assurance about those claims, and how do you identify the person? How do you, So it's a big mess, and I think that you could definitely help in this area. And I think a fresh look on the problem would help too. I'll send you an email also with two links. One is the OAuth identity link. We can add that to the notes. This is just an idea, a one-page idea I had for a new identity standard. But I think it outlines the fact that I don't think because there's OpenID Connect, we're done. That's definitely hardly the case. And then I'll send a link to that silly $1 million prize. This may be, if you figure this thing out, you deserve the reward. So try and claim it.
Awesome. And we found the link for the $1 million award. That didn't take a long time with the Google search, but the other link we'd really appreciate your idea for new identity thing on in.
It's actually off my GitHub. If you go to GitHub/NYNYMike, then you'll see there's a link there for OAuth through identity. I apologize for being delayed. Somehow it didn't make it on my calendar, but I'm glad I was here. I'm glad I got the email.
No problem. And we really appreciate your time today, Mike. It's been super helpful. We're definitely going to be in touch later on. If we end up putting a charter together for this work, we'd like you to review it and make sure that we're capturing all your concerns and are still kind of trying to head in the right direction. But that's going to be a month or two before we get there.
I'll throw in one more concern, and this reminds me. So if you're at RSA Security, I got two talks into RSA this year, one on authentication and the other one on trust elevation. So this is another interesting point about authentication not being a one-time event, but as you transact business or provide additional claims, the relying party or website might want a stronger credential. So like typically, like if you look at your bank, like if you check your statement, it's using your web browser cookie and a password. So when you go to add a new wire recipient, they're sending you an SMS number. So that's an example of trust elevation. So I'm giving a talk about this at RSA. So this is another one of those problems where this is a partly unsolved problem about how do you get interoperability across domains for trust elevation. And it's also closely related to gathering attributes, because sometimes in order to elevate trust, it doesn't mean just collecting different types of authentication, but maybe sometimes it means collecting word claims.
Right.
So anyway, your work's cut out for you, and you're over time, so I wish you the best of luck, and let me know if there's anything I can do. And if you are at RSA, definitely let me know, and we can chat about it in person.
We will certainly do that. I don't think we'll be at RSA, but we'll definitely contact you via email or phone within the next month or two. Awesome. Thanks so much, Mike. We really appreciate it again. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Bill.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.